with the arts, talent is one of the few means by which a person might overcome poor Songbun. Though this is by no means guaranteed. The creme de la creme will attend the grandiose Manyangde School Children's Palace, renovated with bright, marbleized splendor in 2015, with departments for virtually every field in the arts, sciences, and athletics. Here, tourists and foreign dignitaries are customarily taken on tours to witness classes and rehearsals, culminating in spectacular performances where the country's brightest little singers, dancers, acrobats, musicians, and actors showcase their craft with stunning perfection. Post-secondary school, after training for 5 years at one of the nation's art academies, performers will be taken on at any number of theaters or bands, while visual artists will typically go on to employment at one of the art studios, the most venerated of which is Mansudae, which boasts around 1,000 visual artists and 4,000 assistants and administrative staff. Mansudae is where the huge statues of the Kims on Mansu Hill, and the hundreds of others elsewhere in the country, were produced. All of Pyongyang's murals and mosaics are rendered here. And it is where, in the Department of Oil Painting, the vast majority of the works showcased in the Korean Art Gallery on Kim Il-sung Square were painted. Once employed at an art studio, artists are given free rein to paint or sculpt anything they want. They have a monthly quantitative quota to fill, but subject matter and content are up to them. By that point, they are trusted, as they have already undergone the lifelong ideological training that is guaranteed to result in only correct images. Occasionally, or often, depending on the department and medium, a commission will come in that will require the talents of one artist, in the case of, say, an oil painting or small tapestry, or up to an entire department for monumental sculptures or mosaics. Successful artists work their way up the reward system. The highest commendation is People's Artist, the second highest, Merited Artist. There are only a couple hundred artists awarded with such designations. Most live in Pyongyang and are gifted with luxury housing for their families in a new high-rise facing the Taedong River, and extra rations. The most successful might even win the Kim Il-sung Prize. So artists live relatively charmed existences in the DPRK. They might be granted inspiration trips to idyllic locales in the countryside, or, rarer, sojourn abroad. Artists work at their studios from Monday to Friday. On Saturdays, like everyone else, they are required to attend study sessions, where the theoretical writings of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il might be taught, a further extension of the Juche aesthetics they absorb during their studies at the Art Academy. Upon retirement, they may join the Songhua Art Studio in Pyongyang, which holds its own exhibitions of members' work. There is, however, no star system among artists and writers like there is in the West. Rather, there are famous works. North Koreans, when asked about their favorite novels, can recite vivid plot summaries, but most often won't be able to tell you the author's name. In art, the most iconographic painting is undoubtedly Chung Yung-man's Evening Glow at Kongsun Steelworks. The sky is alive with that fiery dawn glow, smoke spewing snakishly out of the factory towers above the glistening river. Never mind the content, Chung's painting can be admired for color alone. Standing in front of the painting, Ms. Kwok tells us the story behind its creation, that its theme was suggested to the artist by Kim Jong-il personally. Full of inspiration, Chung set out for Nampo in search of scenes to paint. When he happened to catch a glimpse of the factory at the waning hour, he recalled the general's advice, dutifully brought out his paints and a blank canvas, and set to work. Really, the whole city can be treated as one gigantic art museum. Look at the subways, the veins of the city. The stations, one extended gallery. Each designed by a different artist meditating upon a theme based on the station's name. Red Star, Glory, Revolution, Liberation. The palatial architecture, with its marble pillars and arches and extravagant chandeliers, will be familiar to anyone who's taken a subway in Moscow. But it is the colorful mosaics, made collectively by the Mansudae Art Studio, that are worth dwelling on as you await your train's arrival. At Prosperity Station, there's the great leader Kim Il-sung among workers, stretching across the rear wall, with the middle-aged maestro marching against the smoking factory chimneys of a golden sunset, his open trench coat flapping in the wind as a dozen happy, smiling blue and white-collar workers follow close on his trail. The murals of Construction Station dramatize the rebuilding of Pyongyang after the war, while Glory Station's centerpiece is the spiritual birthplace of the Korean nation, Mount Paektu, the birthplace, according to propaganda, of Kim Jong-il. Outside the country, it is known that his actual birthplace was a Siberian army camp, where his father was in exile. In the West, Kim Jong-il has long been mocked as an emblem of high camp, with his pompadour hairdo, fur-collared jacket, oversized designer shades, and long-hemmed pants obscuring those custom-made pointy high heels he wore to obscure his challenged verticality. In a West where, not so long ago, racist, late-colonial Dr. No caricatures were evoked to propagandize an evil Asian other, and arguably still filter into our characterizations of the Chinese and North Koreans, Kim Jong-il seemed to fit the part. A wizened gook Liberace with blood on his fingers and world domination on the brain. Defectors often claim that Kim Jong-il in actuality enjoyed far less popular support than his father. Others nevertheless express admiration for what they characterize as his artistic genius. Even though he never made any art himself, his wizardry behind the entire North Korean culture industry is well known. Those who knew him personally have said that he had the personality of a temperamental artist rather than a politician. Simultaneous with his role at the OGD, Jong-il was also given another position, head of the Propaganda and Agitation Department, PAD. There's a good reason why Kim Il-sung allowed his son to wrest power away from his hands. He didn't notice it happening. As head of the PAD, Jong-il accelerated the expansion of his father's personality cult in a full-on artistic assault. The elder Kim was in turn bedazzled by the city being erected around him. The city of him. Everywhere he went, he would see his likeness projected. Even when he himself did not appear in a painting or sculpture or film, it was made clear through a dedicatory plaque, speech, or text that the monumental work was indeed about him, inspired by him, a promulgation of his greatness. Clearly, Jong-il recognized early on his father's weakness for flattery. His role at the PAD allowed him to indulge that weakness to a distracting degree. In philosophy, Jong-il adapted the nascent idea of juche, or subject thought, as one commentator has translated it, only to recenter it upon the idea of the Suryong, the great leader. Man is the master of all things. This is how the juche idea is often summarized, leading to the erroneous belief that juche is some sort of crudely sloganified existentialism. But actually, the juche doctrine states quite clearly that all people are in need of a great leader for guidance. And in Korea, that great leader could only be one man. Under Kim Jong-il, juche thought morphed into Kim Il-sungism, wherein the great leader guides the party, which by 1973 had come to mean Kim Jong-il himself. And the party then guides the people. Anyone seen to challenge the post-Kopsan-purge ideology of Kim Il-sungism was a reactionary. This was a charge that nobody wanted to risk. By then, the justice system was well known by all inhabitants of the DPRK. If you are accused of a political crime, that means you are guilty. The punishment can range from banishment from Pyongyang, if you are lucky enough to live there in the first place, to being sent to the mountains, the local patois for imprisonment in the hellish environs of labor and re-education camps, from which many never emerge, to public execution in front of your fellow citizens. In most cases, punishment would be applied not only to you, but to your family, extending into three generations. In 1973, the Ministry of State Security was created to oversee this system. The dreaded Baobu as it has come to be known in North Korea, a massive surveillance and political police organ that reported directly to Kim Jong-il of the OGD. Thus, the monolithic ideological system that Kim Il-sung created was solidified under Kim Jong-il, who came to be known as the Dear Leader. The cultification of Kim Il-sung in politics, philosophy, art, and culture, and everyday life, was deployed as a weapon to further Kim Jong-il's own powers, to the extent that they eventually overcame his father's, even while his father remained the de facto ruler until his death in 1994. Chapter 13. Walking through the empty halls of the Korean Art Gallery, I discover a richer history of modern art, beyond all the girl mothers and Kims. It is rooted in the first decades of the North Korean state. In the corridor behind the main hall where temporary exhibitions take place, a number of small oil paintings dating from the 1940s and 1950s have been installed. Paintings refreshingly unideological. Images of a different time, a different place. Among them are the landscapes of Moon Hak-soo, a South Korean artist who fled to the North before the war and remained there until his death in 1988. His paintings show the clear influence of Delacroix, though Ms. Kwok denies this when I bring it up. All Korean, she insists. Finally, we are taken to the third floor of the museum, normally off-limits to foreign visitors. Here, we find in reverse chronology a whole suite of paintings that further flesh out the DPRK's art history up to the present day. We walk to the back rooms to begin our tour in the 1950s and 1960s, an era of greater artistic freedom compared to today. While there certainly isn't any abstract expressionism on display, there is at least more variety in the individual styles, veering between Soviet socialist realism and French impressionism. Love, a painting from 1961 centered on two young girls fishing from a boat, is an idyllic landscape study that could have been copied from Degas or Seurat were it not for the Korean faces. Again, I mention this possible influence to Ms. Kwok, who shakes her head in response. No, no, no. All Korean. Pure. Patently untrue. As art historical scholarship in the South has documented, a number of Korean artists during the colonial period went to study in Japan, where French academicism was in vogue. All the same, by the early 1960s, the Kim Il-sung cult in the fine arts had already begun to emerge. And in the 1970s and 1980s, coinciding with Kim Jong-il's rise to power, the paintings became increasingly didactic and limited in both style and subject matter. A classic example of the era's kitsch would be Ri Dong-hee's clunky rendering of two peasant women, their facial expressions overcome with dumb joy, as they tend to pigs by a river in a springtime rural landscape, with a large mountain in the background. Everywhere you go, mountains. 90% of the country is mountainous, and these daunting formations are deployed as an easy metaphor for the majesty and natural endurance of the political system. The mountain that can be neither moved nor destroyed. Though there is also the city. A 1988 oil painting by Sung Gon Chan depicts two young women on bikes, delivering morning copies of the Rodong Sinmun. They make their way down the slippery path of Chongwang Street, the twin towers of the Koryo Hotel shining in the background. The colorful reflection on the rain-stained street implies that the sun has broken through. Stormy weather is out of the way, as are the two young women, who happily ride toward the bright socialist utopia beneath the virginal sky. Of all the art forms, Kim Jong-il loved cinema best. He never personally directed any films, at least none bear his name in the credits, but he was by all means the executive producer, the man who ran the state's cinema industry for the entirety of his adult life. From 1965's The Path of Awakening onward, Jong-il was on the set of every film shot in the country nearly once a day to give on-the-spot guidance. And while he forbade his citizens from watching foreign media, Kim himself had a personal library of more than 15,000 films. Some in his inner circle would later claim that Jong-il's love of celluloid may have clouded his perception of reality. According to one confidant, he believed that the exploits of James Bond were virtual docudramas, lightly fictionalized accounts of real-world international espionage affairs. Appropriately, beginning in the 1970s, Jong-il engaged in a number of his own 007 hijinks. He sent his agents to Japan, where they kidnapped a number of random citizens and brought them to the DPRK to train spies in Japanese language and customs. North Korean agents made a number of assassination attempts on the leaders of South Korea. Most notoriously, Jong-il arranged to have his favorite South Korean filmmaker, Shin Sang-ok, and his former wife, the actress Choi Yun-hee, kidnapped and brought to the North, where he forced them to make films in an effort to garner international attention for North Korean cinema. The plan didn't work. After making 7 films in the North for Kim, including a hilariously bad remake of Godzilla, 1985's Pulgasari, Shin and Choi managed to escape from their minders while visiting a film festival in Vienna, and made it safely to the American embassy. Pulgasari aside, the films Shin and Choi made in the North brought Kim Jong-il the attention he was seeking from international critics. But whatever contribution they made was not to outlast their stay. DPRK cinema, while of limited interest to diehard researchers of the culture, proves to be an endurance test for everyone else. When ideology is forced to reign over every other impulse, style suffers. Not to mention plot and character. After all, no Korean can ever be depicted as truly evil. That limits the potential for conflict, which is the place where plot holds its audience's attention captive. And when there is a lack of believable human emotion, tons of sentiment must be employed as filler material. Hence the emotional, melodramatic style of acting that dominates in these films, wherein characters are constantly bursting into tears when they're not unnaturally smiling or laughing at innocent nothings, boastfully asserting their happiness and great fortune to have been born in the Korean people's paradise. Illustrations of ideal people, flawless heroes of the revolution that are meant to be emulated in real life. Films that are less meant to entertain than to impart lessons to the audience. Lessons that can be contained in pithy one-sentence summations to be uttered aloud in study sessions following the film's viewing. What the development of Juche aesthetics under Kim Jong-il entailed was an intense delimiting of subject matter. A micromanager to the most obsessive degree, Kim Jong-il personally issued the decrees. Everything painted, filmed, sculpted, or written must include a seed. An ideological nugget of glorification of the Suryong and the state he founded. Eventually, Jong-il himself would come to be included as the second subject of glorification in this illustrious canon. A move that, whether he initiated it himself or not, he apparently never protested. This even extends to academia, where every paper on no matter what subject, be it mathematics or zoology, must begin with a quote from one of the Kims. Among the countless books Jong-il is said to have written, one defector claims they were taught that he wrote 1,500 books during his 3 years of study at Kim Il-sung University alone, are a number of treatises on art, literature, cinema, and aesthetics. Translations of these works are available for sale at bookshops in every hotel lobby and at the Foreign Languages Bookshop off Kim Il-sung Square, which stocks exclusively books by and about Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and Kim Jong-un, with a few other titles by North Korean authors thrown in. North Koreans themselves apparently don't read any of the texts authored by the Kims unless they are forced to. For example, nearly everyone must memorize the annual New Year's Day address for recitation at their Saturday study sessions. But if you ask your tour guide for recommendations on which book by the great leader you should read, the typical response you get is, "All of them." The reason why becomes clear when you crack open several titles at random and begin to read. The contents are all more or less the same redundancies, repeated with minor variation, ad nauseam. In actuality, and particularly in primary and secondary school, it is the biographies of the leaders that form the propagandistic foundation of North Korean education. The illegibility of so much of the theory is reflected in artistic practice. Part of the bizarreness of the personality cults, to outsider eyes, is how kitsch it all appears. To my North Korean hosts, it is all just art with a capital A. The visual cacophony of the city that constantly surrounds them, wherever they may go. I feel a certain degree of guilt for the further degrees of sublimity and cynicism I am able to read into the visual culture of Pyongyang whenever I am there. What first appears as perverse spectacle, however, soon becomes accepted as the humdrum quotidian. When I look at this art, the paintings, the films, the performances, and the closed aesthetic system from which it emerges, I can't help but see a distance from the Soviet style of socialist realism that it is so often dismissed as by outsiders. The North has fostered its own realism, a realism no less distant from the real than socialist realism was in the Soviet Union, but still distinct from that iconography. It's a realism that extends into daily life in ways that other totalitarian aesthetic systems could only dream of. Norco realism might have roots that can be traced back to Stalin's Soviet Union and Imperial Japan. But its greatest accomplishment is the creation of its own version of time. And it's an ongoing process. The Jucha calendar to replace the Gregorian. The setting of the clocks back 30 minutes. The lack of urgency in everyday life. That painting style that never quite evolves. The homilification of the banal, inscribed across every available surface. On my first visit to the country in 2012, I felt that the DPRK remains perpetually stuck somewhere in the middle of the 20th century. Now I realize that the system's production of time is welded to an oblivious stance toward all those aspects of the modern world that do not concern it. Chapter 14. When we finish our tour of the museum, much of our own time is eaten up with Alexander's quest to buy an Ararang smartphone. He has been wanting one of these geek DPRK souvenirs for a long time, but didn't manage to buy one on his last stay here. Foreigners residing in the country can also buy service on the local KoreaLink network, albeit on a separate network that only allows you to call other foreigners in the country. You are blocked from dialing any Korean numbers. Unlike Koreans, you can even buy an expensive data package that allows you to connect to the internet. Their smartphones likewise are barred from dialing foreign numbers and connect only to the country's internal intranet. We spend what's left of the afternoon at the International Communications Center by the Potong River, trying to get this all arranged. As in most socialist countries I've lived or traveled in, such procedures require endless hours of bureaucratic hassle. In a moment of impatience, I confront Alexander. What's the point of buying service? We're going to be here for a month. The only people we can call are each other, and we're going to be together the entire time. It's absurd. I'm very sorry, Travis, but for me, it's necessary. He winks at me. Later, when we're out of earshot of our guides, Alexander will explain that he wants to call a contact of his working in the recently established French consular service. This, Alexander reasons, will help us cement our big plan for Saturday night, to visit the diplomatic compound, which has its very own nightclub. For dinner, we visit a newly opened restaurant below the Kwangbok Shopping Center. We dine on my favorite local dish, Pyongyang naengmyeon, thin, brown, chewy buckwheat noodles in an ice-cold radishy broth, piled high with sliced meat, fiery kimchi, cucumber, and spices. For more flavor, stir in a spoonful of mustard and a few squirts of vinegar. Sip the broth to see if you've got it right, and then grab your metal chopsticks and dig in. What the hell were you doing in class today? Learning to make animal noises? Alexander snorts over his noodles. Sorry, Travis, but the door was open and it was, rather loud. It was indeed carnal, Alec adds. I know, I have to learn vowels. What can you do? Well, you could close the door, but that's not something likely to happen. particularly when there's only one student, and that student happens to be an American bastard. How would you rate your teacher? Is he doing a good job? Alec asks Alexander, performing quality control. Yes, he's good, but he can't speak English. Or French, of course. So he can't explain new words. You've got to get the Korean English app. It comes on the phone. I was checking. It's not on there. What about you, Travis? How's Ms. Park? I pull out my phone and show him the video I made of Ms. Park performing the vowels. I press play and start repeating Ms. Park's intonations, replicating the animal noises. Alec and Alexander laugh. This gets Min's attention. She wants in on the joke, so she gets up from her place at the table to join us. Like most young Pyongyangites, she's obsessed with snapping photos and making videos on her phone to share with her friends. In the split second before she arrives over my shoulder, Alexander shoots me a look from the corner of his eye. I immediately realize I'm fucked. I attempt to zoom in on Ms. Park's face, but it's too late. For there, in the upper left-hand corner of the video, is my mistake. A cut-off quarter of the Kim Jong-il portrait above the whiteboard. Min sees through my lame volte-face immediately.
Could you scroll back, please? To the full image?
I have no choice but to follow her directive.
Can you delete this video? She asks.
Her voice has this curiously flat, affectless, unemotional monotone that I've never heard before. It unnerves me. I'm really sorry, I say, sputtering. I didn't mean to do it. It's just for studying. I didn't even realize it had happened until now. I promise not to share it with anyone.
Please delete it tonight after you've finished studying.
She sits back down at her place at the table and resumes eating. I hadn't noticed the gaffe before, but neither had Ms. Park. She had even asked to see the video after I filmed it, but that was more out of vanity to see how she looked. I wonder if North Koreans themselves are forced to be so vigilant about accidentally capturing fragments of the Kim's likenesses. Since they appear virtually everywhere, it must happen all the time. When we're alone back at the Sosan after dinner, Alexander whispers in the elevator that I should just back up the video on my laptop and delete it from my phone. I know, I tell him. Of course, I had already thought of that. I'm such a fucking idiot, I sigh, grabbing my forehead. Don't say that, Alexander whispers sternly. You didn't do anything wrong. She's the one who's wrong. You were just doing your work. Things like this are going to happen all the time. We can't let them get to us, or else we'll start to believe in it ourselves. We have to remind ourselves constantly so we don't lose our minds. It's them who are fucked up, not us.
Part 4. Us and Them. Chapter 15. 3 days into it, those clusters of letters have been put together to form actual words I can now pronounce. Class is ending, so Ms. Park suggests we make another video for tonight's review session. As I take out my phone, the lady with the perm walks into the classroom, surveys the scene, and whispers something to Ms. Park.
Mr. Travis, Ms. Park says in her halting English. Video. Look.
I show them the video I just made. This time I made sure to shoot from a wider angle so that the portraits of father and son wouldn't be cut off. There they are, in full, their toothy smiles beaming over Ms. Park's head as she dutifully repeats each Korean word written on the board. The two women study the video closely and exchange whispered commentary. Ms. Park then walks to the front of the classroom and gestures below the portraits.
No, Mr. Kim Il-sung, Mr. Kim Jong-il, she says.
I get it. I show the administrator that I'm deleting the file. Smile. Happy? Obviously, Min tattled. I hope it won her lots of points. It is the last time Ms. Park or her boss will mention it. I go on to make lots of videos and take photos each day. In a small gesture of rebellion, I deliberately make sure I get the portraits in each frame. After all,
As long as they appear in their smiling entirety, there's no rule against it. After class, we make another coffee run. This time we try the coffee shop at the Pyongyang Hotel. Alex says it's considered the best and most expensive in town.
Alec, I forgot to tell you the news, Min says on the ride over. I got a promotion in June. Now I'm senior tour guide, just one step below Comrade Kim.
We congratulate her. I ask her what exactly the promotion entails, besides the rise in rank. It's one of those questions she doesn't like to answer.
You get to do more stuff? People, respect you more.
She trails off.
Ah, so you get to boss people around now, Alexander prods.
She laughs.
Yes, it's true.
She slaps her fist in her palm, mock menacingly. Ro stares out the window glumly. In the West, they're called millennials. In North Korea, they're known as the Changmadong, Market Grounds Generation. They came of age during the Arduous March, those years in the mid to late 1990s following Kim Il-sung's death, when economic collapse, spurred by the demise of the Soviet Union, combined with environmental disaster to cause the largest famine in the country's history. The public food distribution system that North Koreans had by and large been dependent on until then broke down. Informal markets sprang up everywhere throughout the country. Markets that all citizens now rely upon, to greater and lesser degrees. Nowadays, you can acquire just about anything you want in North Korea, provided you have the hard currency to pay for it. Far from being cut off from the rest of the world, the markets have put North Koreans directly in the middle of it. Daily provisions, pharmaceuticals, luxury items are bought and exchanged. But not only. Just as everywhere else in the 21st century, information is the most valuable commodity. At the markets, whispered gossip and hearsay flow relatively freely. Tidbits much juicier than anything printed in the Rodong Sinmun, or dramatically intoned on the nightly news. In providing North Koreans with a degree of autonomy, the markets have driven a wedge between the people and the government, especially the 20-somethings of the Changmadong generation, people of Min's age, who have never known a moment in time when the government provided anything for them, who still hold childhood memories of the dead and dying in the streets. Shopping is Min's favorite activity, besides eating. She takes a subversive delight in all forms of consumption. She also takes an intense interest in all our consumption habits and goes to great lengths to accommodate all of them. It is rare that we go into a shop where she herself doesn't wind up buying something. What her promotion means, what all such promotions these days mean, is an increase in independence granted to pursue business ventures outside of tourism. With all the bad news circulating since Warmbier's detention, the numbers have taken a dive. But thanks to the new rules that have been adapted as a result of the ground-up swelling of the market economy since the 1990s, it is not something that Comrade Kim and his managerial colleagues need fret about. There are other ways of earning money as a state enterprise. You can do virtually anything. For Min, it is medicine and luxury French cosmetics. Tough because of the sanctions, but not undoable. Especially when you have access to foreign visitors or else can make trips outside the country yourself. Just one day before we arrived, Min had returned from a trip to Uganda, where she had been a guest at the DPRK embassy in Kampala. The coffee shop at the Pyongyang Hotel has a separate entrance outside next to the lobby. It is actually a built-on rooftop addition to the hotel. You take the elevator up to the second floor, or the stairs when the electricity's out, and enter into a rather sumptuous space that wouldn't look out of place in a middle-class neighborhood in any Western city. Here, the furnishings represent the height of glamour. Wood paneling, Japanese-style silk-embossed folding screens that can be moved to surround a table when a couple desires more privacy, and a spiral staircase leading to a glassed-in rooftop terrace boasting views of the Pyongyang Grand Theater across the street, with its excellent mural of Kim Il-sung's mother in Chosonot, wielding a pistol.
The Moranbong Band's summer hit, Dash Toward the Future, lulls through the background speakers, a danceable pop anthem extolling this great era of the Workers' Party. Behind the counter, a beautiful young barista operates the gleaming, gilded silver espresso machine. She was sent to China last summer, where she learned the craft, and takes a quiet pleasure in demonstrating her expertise. After I put in my order for an Americano, she points to the selection of beans on display from across Africa and Latin America, and asks me which I prefer. Alec, who has a sweet tooth, is surprised to find his favorite South Korean dessert concoction on the menu, a pile of shaved ice topped with cream and strawberries and gooey syrup. Alexander, whose teetotaldom apparently extends to caffeine, watches as the preparations are made, clearly more interested in the barista than the goods on offer.
"Get a dessert," urges Alec. "This is good shit, man."
Alexander looks skeptical.
"I thought I told you, Alec. Ice, not a good idea."
Alec contemplates this as he watches the machine spew out tiny frosty bits.
"I'm sure they make it with filtered water."
A tremor of hope in his voice. While we await our order, with the single employee behind the counter, it's not exactly Starbucks-paced service, I break away from the group to sneak downstairs to the hotel lobby. The Pyongyang Hotel is one of the older accommodation facilities in the capital, and it shows. The lobby looks like it hasn't been upgraded since the 1970s. Anyway, I'm not here to inquire about a room. It is, rather, the first time in my life I've gone looking for a lawyer. Michael Hay, a practicing lawman from England, is said to reside here in the Pyongyang Hotel. One of those shadowy figures of expat lore I've been longing to meet. His firm largely represents foreign companies looking to do business in the DPRK, offering advice and protection in the event anything goes askew. Legend has it he even sued the DPRK government in local courts once over a copyright infringement case on behalf of a client, and won. The other legend has it that he likes to drink, so I'm going to offer to buy him a couple to see what stories might flow forth.
"Is Mr. Michael in?"
The front desk receptionist appears startled to see a foreigner standing before him unaccompanied. He picks up the phone and dials. No answer. "Thanks anyway." I decide to go up and check for myself. Min is also interested in meeting the guy, since she's now doing business herself. He could be a strategic partner for her, and he must have contacts. But I want to meet with him first, to gauge the likelihood of setting up a meeting. And I want to hear the stories he likely wouldn't tell in front of her. I make my way up the stairwell, shrouded by leotard-clad teenagers stretching their legs on its banister in preparation for the evening's dance performance. Zionichi Koreans, as they're called, are Korean residents of Japan affiliated with Chungryan, a pro-DPRK organization. Many of them send their sons and daughters here in the summer for a few weeks to explore their cultural roots in the fatherland. For some reason, they always stay at the Pyongyang Hotel, perhaps to keep them isolated, since so few other guests ever stay here. On the second floor, I find a door marked Hay, Kalb & Associates, surrounded by regular hotel rooms. I knock three times. I guess that the room inside is a simple suite, fitted with an official-looking desk, a bedroom off to the side. But I'm not destined to find out. Nobody's answering. Mr. Michael is on vacation. Later, I will come to find out that just the week prior, he had left the country for good. Back in the coffee shop, a well-heeled couple has taken two of the empty seats. They speak discreetly over steaming cups, the man vaping from an electronic cigarette. Min stands immersed before an illustrated display on the wall that explains, in English, where the coffee we're about to drink comes from, how it is harvested, its history, its health benefits.
"The coffee is expensive here," she remarks. "How much is a cup of coffee in Germany?"
I tell her it averages now between 180 and 220 in euros. "In Italy, you can get an espresso for only 80 cents," I add. She considers this information and then turns toward me, a new idea lighting up her face.
"I think I will open a coffee shop,"
she says. A coffee shop that is affordable, that ordinary people can go to. Because at these prices, only rich people can afford to drink coffee. It is an original idea, and one that she is determined to not let go of. She takes a pad and pen out of her bag and begins feverishly making notes. By the time we finally get our order and make our way to a table in the adjoining restaurant, Min has her phone to her ear and is headed down the hallway for some privacy. The dictionary app, says Alexander. I need to get it, Alec. Seriously, I couldn't understand any of the teacher's explanations in the lesson today. Now it is very difficult, Ro comments, settling in next to us, and then laughs at the inevitability, the black humor of totalitarianism. I don't get it. I bought the phone. Why can't I just get the language software? It came on mine when I got the CorelLink phone, but that was a couple years ago, says Alec. The situation has changed now, Ro notes, meaning the rules have changed. He shrugs. He is used to it, the arbitrariness of the system. Not worth moaning about, not even worth mentioning. What is, is. He stands up and stretches and then saunters over to Min, who is whispering into her phone in a hidden corner by the bar. They don't want foreigners to have any of the local apps now, Alex says. I guess that includes the dictionary. Alexander shrugs. Then what's the point of even owning this phone? Just to call other foreigners, I guess. You know what it is, Alexander whispers, now furious. They don't really want us to learn the language. Why else would they forbid foreigners from using a dictionary? The less we know, the better. Min suddenly appears before our table. Everyone finished with your coffee? Let's go. Where are we off to now? She leans in for a whisper. We're going to try and get you the app. We, they to be precise, try everything. We go to the Chungbo Electronics Center behind the Ryongyang Hotel, where Min and Ro attempt to bribe the employees into installing the software on Alexander's phone while we wait outside. To no avail. Then they take us to some upscale shopping district for elites stashed away behind a row of high-rise apartment buildings. Shops hawking high-end electronics, designer brand clothing smuggled in from China, hidden behind a hotel that only North Koreans can stay at. An area I repeatedly try and fail to locate on my tourist map later that night. That doesn't work either. At least we're getting to see areas I haven't visited before. The Pandora's Box of Pyongyang. By now, it is dark, around dinner time. We drive through the streets of the nocturnal city, clueless as to where we're headed. The Koreans won't tell us. Hua cruises along a quiet, narrow stretch of the River Potong. No one's out on any dates on this balmy night. Too hot for summer love. We pull down a narrow alleyway. Hua cuts off the headlights. In the front seat, Min and Ro look around nervously. There's a bar at the end of the alleyway that seems to be jumping with people, but nobody's milling around outside. And the soldiers manning the security booth in front of the apartment house at the end of the alleyway have nodded off. The lone street lamp flickers out, leaving us in the pitch black. Detectives on a stakeout. Min picks up her phone, utters a few words into the receiver. A man emerges out of the darkness. Min hops out of the car to meet him. He hands her a bag. Min climbs back into the car. The guy remains outside, pacing back and forth in the darkness. Ro looks around nervously as Min takes the object out of the bag. It is a tablet, the locally made Samjeon brand. She switches it on, scrolls across the screen. Shit, she says in English. The app's not there. Min hops out, hands the bag back to the guy. We drive off. That was my brother, she says, once we're a safe distance down the road. You collect things here, says Alexander, ranting. Look at this. I have this fucking medal saying what a good worker I am, how much value I have, and you know what? If I work hard, say the right things in front of the right people, next month they're gonna give me an even bigger fucking medal. It's after midnight now, and we're smoking cigarettes on my balcony, staring out at the dark city below. It's like a moldy blanket, all those streets in West Pyongyang, and hardly any lights, as most of them are turned off after a certain hour. Every once in a while a car goes by, and you have to wonder who's in it. Who would be out driving around this time of night? Where they might be going? You have to have a special license that permits you to drive after dark. Min is a good example, Alexander continues. When you asked her the other day whether she was a member of the Workers' Party, "No, but I'm a member of the Socialist Youth League." Pointing to the gold plating on her Kim Il-sung badge? That's how it works here. The gilding on the badges. The little signs designating reward, status, honor. You get stuff. It gives you a sense, not just of belonging, but of acceptance. Yeah, I'm part of this thing. I'm ingrained in it. I play my role. They reward me. And next time I'll get something bigger, better. A watch, a car. That's what you see. These colonels with their reward Rolexes. The medals, the badges, the insignia weighing down their uniforms. This is who I am, a thing you can hold in the palm of your hand that can be displayed. And eventually, you reach the level where you get to give these little rewards out yourself, to pull rank. Then you're really somebody. Somebody with a capital S. Somebody people then owe something to. You get to lord it over them. This is what keeps the system going. And it's all fake. Fake honor. Because this stuff, these little trinkets, they all mean nothing. Take one wrong step and you lose them all. Because that's their dual purpose. Presence with the threat of absence. They're there, in your hand, pinned to your collar, your uniform, to remind you that everything you've been given can be taken away. And quite easily. Your life along with them. Wherever I am in the world, on summer nights, I like to leave my windows open, listen to the sounds of the street as I drift off at night. It puts me in a sexy mood, the amalgamation of languages spoken, the sizzling street food, passing vehicles, all those illicit and mysterious nighttime exchanges. To remain a part of it, the city's soundscape, even as I drift off into the ether. The hutongs of Beijing, where people barbecue until 3 a.m., oblivious to sleep's demands. Old Havana, with its wisps of music drifting up from the Malecon. But in Pyongyang, all is silent come nightfall. And at the Sosan Hotel, they've got us towered up on the 28th floor, at a suicidal distance from the street. Then there's the nothingness we're surrounded by. Trees, mostly. A perpetually disused golf course. All the empty fields and stadiums making up the sports district. There are no residential complexes here whatsoever. Even where there is, there are no congregations of insomniac nighttime wanderers. Law forbids it. And even if it didn't, nearly everyone collapses in collective exhaustion anyway, as a consequence of the 8 hours of work and 8 hours of study that Kim Il-sung once delineated as the ideal socialist day. They leave behind them a silence that is eerie, chilling in the depths of its pervasiveness. Chapter 16. Min's corpulence is something. It is on display, albeit modestly, in an expensive purple polka-dot designer bathing suit, the kind with a sort of frilly belt around the waist. Modesty is insisted upon, especially for women. With her $500 Gucci sunglasses crowning the picture, Min, pale and perfumed, looks like she's stepped out of a high-end resort into this scene of third-world revelry. We're on the beach in the port city of Nampo, about an hour's bumpy drive from Pyongyang on the peninsula's west coast. It's Sunday, and the beach is packed with locals making the most of the day off, getting shit-faced, diving into the sea, singing karaoke, dancing in the sand. The beachgoers eye the foreign invaders with a mixture of curiosity and astonishment.
A local security apparatchik approaches Ro, asks him who he is, who he's with, who these foreigners are. He's never seen Ro around these parts. Who is he to bring a foreign delegation here before first securing local permission? Ro gives him a one-sentence answer. The guy and his cronies immediately back off. Min wanders over to ask Ro about the exchange. Ro relays it, and they both crack up. A laugh that says, "These country bumpkins." Min wanders around the scrawny, sunburnt peasants, casually owning the scene. To be able to afford Min's swimwear ensemble, most of these people would have to sacrifice a decade or more of their earnings. Some of the women don't even have bathing suits, wading into the water with their pants rolled high. Modesty also applies to the male sex. No Speedos here, just swim shorts and boxers for those who can't afford them. The arduous march that these Jangmadangers and their elders managed to survive is a euphemistic phrase, one of many that the regime has recycled. The first arduous march had nothing to do with famine, but rather referred to the freezing winter of 1938 and 1939, when Kim Il-sung's guerrilla resistance movement was very nearly defeated by the Japanese. The second arduous march, 1994 to 1998, that remains the formative experience for most Jangmadangers, resulted in the death by starvation of between 240,000 and 3.5 million people, according to a number of unverifiable estimates. The actual statistics have never been released by the government. Of those who survived, many remained stunted, whether vertically, intellectually, or both. Many are still afflicted with diseases and health conditions stemming from chronic childhood malnutrition. Food shortages have been a recurring problem throughout the DPRK's existence. Ever since Kim Il-sung decided to follow his leader Stalin in focusing his economy on the development of heavy industry, a directive that was zealously carried out, the country has experienced a continual degradation of infrastructure and agriculture. The labor-intensive regimen forced upon a populace fed on a protein-diluted diet leaves them chronically exhausted. On the way to Nampo this afternoon, we drove past the West Sea Barrage. This is perhaps the most lavish example of one of Kim Il-sung's vanity projects. A gargantuan dam upon which precious resources were squandered, resulting in the catastrophic environmental devastation that was no small contributing cause of the resulting famine in the 1990s. Heavy industry versus light industry. Fatness versus emaciation. It is important to us, a North Korean defector in Seoul once explained to me, that our leader is fat. A signifier of wealth, of hope. Even though the people might be half-starved, the image of fatness broadcast by the leader shows the promise of wealth and extravagance. We will all look like that someday, once socialism has fully triumphed, it seems to say. And anyway, we might have it bad, but then other countries must have it much worse. Nobody is starving anymore. It is unknowable how many still believe in the propaganda. Probably not many. Even outside of Pyongyang, people have learned that you have to play the capitalism game in order to survive. Here on the beach, people are skinny, but there is food going around. Beer to drink. Most of it might come from China, but the marshal has made the development of light industry, consumer goods for the masses, a priority, going against the precedent set by his grandfather and followed more or less by his father. Of course, he has little choice in either tolerating these nascent forms of capitalism or investing in consumer goods, housing, infrastructure, and of late, the environment. It's the very least he can do, since the government he inherited proved not so long ago that it cannot be trusted. On the shore, a group of teenagers dances furiously, violently, to instrumental techno remixes of the latest Moranbong band favorites. I study the intense, ice-cold expressions on their faces, the relentlessness of their movement as they flail their limbs about. Ro stares at them and then bursts out laughing. "Bingdu," Alexander whispers in my ear. A locally produced medical remedy, initially produced by the government for export, but now popular among adolescents and adults alike for its curative properties, its ability to diminish hunger and improve concentration and productivity. In the West, it is known as crystal meth. A group of middle-aged men beckons me over, invites me to drink with them. I accept a swig from the bottle of soju I am offered. A little girl, one of their daughters, is dancing to a Norco synth-pop melody blasting from a boombox. As the song arrives at its final kaboom, she lands in a split. The men erupt in cheers and applause, and then pull me onto the makeshift dance floor beneath the canopy they've erected. I do my best. The men laugh and cheer me on. "Which country?" one of them hollers over the music. His comrades turn toward me in anticipation. "Germany," I impulsively lie. They look relieved. "Germany, good," one of them concludes. The others shout their agreement. Our guides let us wander. Min refuses to step foot in the water. Ro occasionally joins us. Alexander and I swim over to another beach, a short distance down the shore. The locals, paddling and floating in the water, greet our white faces ecstatically, a once-in-a-lifetime chance to interact with foreigners. They ask where we are from. This time, I tell the truth. They smile and greet me warmly. Nobody wants to talk politics today. A crowd gathers as the two of us float up to shore. One young man asks me what it is I do for a living. "A writer," I tell him, "and a student at Kim Hyung-jik University of Education." I ask him in return what he does. "I am an ordinary worker," he says. A professional photographer makes her way through the crowd, vending her trade. Alexander waves her over, requests a photograph with our new friends. The photographer looks nervous, but finally agrees to take the photo. We decide to walk back, past makeshift encampments of barbecue and beery karaoke. Alec is deeply engaged in conversation with Min, though his eyes are on a distant beauty dancing with the teenagers across from us. He misses his girlfriend. He's texted her every day on his new phone, but she hasn't replied. Either she's not getting the texts, or else she's pointedly ignoring him. He's beginning to worry he's been forgotten. The day winds its way toward its sunless halt, and we decide to head back to Pyongyang before darkness attains its apotheosis. Climbing into the van, Alexander suddenly remembers the photo. "Min, can you find the photographer lady? Or the office where they print the photos? I want to buy one. And here, get one for Travis, too." He hands her $2. Ro goes off with her. We are left to watch the party die down in the parking lot. People stand around, perplexed as to what to do, where to go next. A little boy dances to a bouncy instrumental played from a mobile phone, surrounded by a circle of women who clap and cheer him on. A man in his mid-20s castigates his girlfriend drunkenly for refusing to get on his motorbike. He hurls insults at her as she stands in a half-circle, surrounded by her female friends. All of them hang their heads low in submissive shame, as the man slurs and wavers. "Look at that," says Alexander. "That's the problem with men in this country. Treating women like that, no respect." "Come on, guys," says Alec. "We're making it worse for them by standing here watching." We climb into the van to make our presence scarce. Eventually, the drunk climbs onto his motorbike and rides off into the dying light without her. Min and Ro return. "The photo?" asks Alexander expectantly. Min mutters something in Korean to Alec. "The photographer was instructed to delete your photo," Alec translates. Chapter 17. It's not that Kim Jong-il was oblivious to the plight of his people, happy to see them starve. When the Soviet Union, the DPRK's chief financial benefactor, dissolved in 1991, it was clear to both Jong-il and his father that tough times were ahead. From the beginnings of the financial crisis that struck the country in the 1990s, and that it has never really recovered from, One of the foreign policy missions undertaken by the regime has been to eventually normalize relations with its number one enemy, the world's greatest military and economic superpower, the United States of America. By closing this long, drawn-out, acrimonious chapter with the U.S.